everyone. My name is Sarah McCarthy. I'm an associate policy researcher at RAND. Before I jump into it, I want to say I am so excited that our first presentation talked about pleasure. We hardly ever talk about pleasure. It is all about the act of unprotected anal intersex. I'm just sex. Say anything sex is on my mind today. But I just want to say I really appreciate that. I think it is absolutely missing from so many things that we're doing, so I'm just really excited about that. And then here I'm focusing on risk. So, that's awesome. So, I'm focusing on individual and sexual network-related HIV and STI risk among sexual minority men in Jackson, Mississippi. For some of you who were in my presentation yesterday that was focused on sexual minority women, I apologize that there's going to be some repeat, but there are some things that just have to be said. Importantly, the results are totally different, so just bear with me. All right, first we've got to start with collaborators. I have Dontrell. Go ahead, raise the roof. Yep, thank you very much. So who's on the research team? We had great people that we're connecting with in Jackson, Mississippi, largely led by Dr. Leandro Mena at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and then also a wonderful organization, My Brother's Keeper, also a team of people in Providence, Rhode Island, at Brown University in Merrim, and there's myself in Santa Monica at RAND. All right, so an overview of what I'm going to do today. I'm going to talk a little bit about the research context, give some background, quick overview of the methods, talk about the results, and then really spend some time on the implications and going forward in terms of what this means. So for the research context, it's important that we talk about Mississippi. You know, my partner says this all the time, that I'm really good at cherry picking the information I want to relay so as to prove my point. Yeah, thank you, PhD. So what I want to highlight in terms of employment, education, and health, basically every single indicator here, Mississippi comes in, if not last, second to last, right? And as I was going through this, I was like, God, if I say that Mississippi is last or second to last in everyone, it's gonna seem as though I'm trying to prove my point. So there were times that even when I was looking at indicators of employment, I was like, okay, well, there's got to be another research institute that puts at least Mississippi, you know, in halfway in between. Not so much. Literally, across all of these different indicators, Mississippi comes in last. All right, there's the bad, but then there's the really good. When we think about these different things with respect to politics, I spent a lot of time looking at the civil rights movements and trying to think, okay, where has Mississippi really been at the forefront of what was happening with respect to progressive movement? There are very few examples. Instead, Mississippi was one of the last grounds to actually make progress when it came to voter registration, et cetera, et cetera. Importantly, what that means is that there were people that were fighting time and time again to actually make progress. Of course, people have heard of Medgar Evers, of the Civil Rights Movement, as well as the students from Jackson State University, two of which were murdered as a result of the national protest with the Vietnam War. So I think, importantly, that there's a long history of political activism that is coming from the state of Mississippi. Also, with respect to music and arts, how many people here have been to a jazz show in Mississippi? Seriously? For the recording, not a single person raised their hand. You should, okay? Put it on your bucket list. There is an incredible history of music and culture. I had fun looking at this. B.B. King, Elvis Presley, Tennessee Williams, James Earl Jones, and Oprah Winfrey were all born in Mississippi. They weren't necessarily raised, but they were all born, okay? I stand by that. And then in terms of food, we've got sweet potato pie, po' boy. I had one the other day. They're very good in New Orleans, but they're also very good in Jackson. Fried chicken and barbecue are all done right. I think more importantly, and this was hard to put in a certain bullet point, meeting the different people that I've worked with in Jackson, there's a real sense of this is where I'm from and this is where I want to be. An increasingly transient world where few people are from any place and stay any place, there is something that's really beautiful and strong in that, and I think that's what we need to tap into when we're talking about what can we actually do differently with respect to HIV/AIDS in Jackson, Mississippi. All right, so in terms of background on HIV/AIDS in the U.S., this is something that you're all very familiar with. The data that I'm talking about is from the meta-analysis that was done by Millett, who was looking at the differences between black or African-American MSN in comparison to other race ethnicities. It looked at U.S., Canada, and... Yes. Participatory presentation. Thank you. UK.
All right, so what we found with respect, Millett found with respect to HIV incidence is basically that black MSM were 3.4 times more likely to be HIV positive. With respect to access to services, very important because this speaks to that structural level as well, that basically black MSM were 55% less likely to use ART and 50% less likely to achieve viral suppression. I know we're experiencing a little fatigue when it comes to the HIV care cascade because we've been talking about it a lot. Critically important is it shows that access isn't a singular point, but instead requires multiple stages of engagement with care. All right, shifting to Mississippi. There's a high prevalence of HIV/AIDS. In Jackson, Mississippi, it's a metropolitan area with the fourth largest prevalence of people living with HIV/AIDS in the country. So in many ways, it's one of the epicenters of the epidemic in the U.S. Again, we see large disparities. This is not new news. I'm just laying out the story. While African Americans represent 37% of the state's population, they comprise 75% of HIV/AIDS cases in the state. Those numbers really speak for themselves. All right, so data collection. I want to be clear that it was a secondary data analysis, so that's why I didn't get to throw in my questions about pleasure. It was based on a cross-sectional study that was conducted at an urban, publicly funded STI clinic in Jackson, Mississippi, between January and June 2011. In terms of our sample, we had included both men and women. This is just the men in the sample, so only 492. We then disaggregated based on self-identified sexual orientation. In terms of those who identified as heterosexual, just about 90%, and those who identified as a sexual minority, just about 10%. Interesting, we had pretty much the same breakdown when we looked at women as well. I do want to say a little bit about the sample composition. We did do a sub-analysis to compare the difference between sexual orientation and sexual practices, and they're actually quite consistent. And I also want to flag the use of the term sexual minority. I think it's incredibly problematic in that when you say there's a minority, that assumes majority. So I encourage us all to think about terms that we can use also for APHA sessions in Chicago 2015, as well as just as the work that we're doing that really sets up a different dynamic for how we talk about sexual diversity. All right, for the analysis, we did a really simple analysis. It's essentially descriptive. We looked at associations for individual-level correlates. That was examined using bivariate chi-square tests. And essentially, we're looking for differences between men who self-identified as heterosexual compared to men who identified either as homosexual, bisexual. We also included MSM as a category. Sexual behaviors were examined also at the partner level using generalized estimated equations to account for the clustering resulting from participants reporting a maximum of 3 sexual partners. Essentially, there were 3 big bins that we looked at: substance abuse, sexual practices, and sexual network characteristics. So just to describe the population a little bit, with respect to age, sexual minority men were more likely to be age 24 or younger. With respect to education, sexual minority men were more likely to have a GED and at least some college. Though, interestingly enough, there was no statistically significant difference with respect to income. So higher education didn't necessarily translate to more money. It's not rocket science, but... All right, so here we go. Looking at STI diagnosis, we basically see that there, by the confidence intervals there, that there wasn't a statistically significant difference between sexual minority men and heterosexual men with respect to rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, or reporting any STI in the past year. I do want to note that for the chlamydia and gonorrhea, that we pulled that from their health records, so that wasn't just self-reported. And basically, when we wrote this up later, we found that it was somewhat representative of the data that was collected by CDC from STI clinics nationally. Note that the CDC data, surprisingly, wasn't disaggregated by sexual orientation nor by race ethnicity. Come on, CDC, step up. Sorry, CDC is here. Okay. So the story actually gets pretty simple from here. With respect to substance abuse, sexual minority men reported lower levels of substance abuse across all categories, every single category, lower levels of substance abuse. Granted, the only one that was statistically significant was respect to marijuana use, but importantly, in every single category, lower levels. All right, sexual practices. So for condom use, sexual minority men were more likely to report always using a condom during anal sex. Also, sexual minority men were less likely to report having more than 5 sex partners in their lifetime. Okay? Looking at sexual network characteristics, we saw that sexual minority men were less likely to have concurrent relationships. Then looking at sexual partner characteristics, really the only thing that stood out is that sexual minority men were more likely to have a one-time sexual encounter, which also is not rocket science if you're talking about Jackson, Mississippi, where same-sex relationships are hugely stigmatized, and so it can be incredibly difficult to have that long-term established relationship. So what does this say? This actually adds to the growing body of evidence that shows that African-American sexual minority men do not engage in higher-risk behaviors. Right? This is essentially what the Millett analysis was showing. I do want to say I had a fabulous research assistant that went through all 194 studies that were included in the Millett analysis. I know, bless its heart, right? And only 5 were conducted in the Deep South. Right? So in one hand, when I was doing this, I was like, you're repeating the wheel here. But I think the issue is that looking at the U.S., that the epidemic is very much centered in the Deep South, but the question is why? Why are the rates going up in the Deep South? Why are the rates going up in these certain groups? When especially as the larger public health community, the traditional risk factors that we look at aren't explaining it. So there's 3 things that I want to highlight in my remaining time. First, let's talk about the physical context. This was a clinic-based sample, all right? And only in speaking with my partners were we really able to hash this out. And it's actually Dr. Mina himself who said, look, Sarah, we're not getting the highest risk MSM. And I said, what are you talking about? And the issue is that the STI clinic that we're working at is known for being an LGBT-friendly space. So if you're LGBT in Jackson, Mississippi, you're going to this one clinic for your everything. Yes, you're going to be tested for STIs, but you're also going to use that time to access different parts of your primary care. Whereas if you're a heterosexual man, you can go to all 10 clinics in Jackson, Mississippi. But if you're specifically going to this one, then you're at particularly high risk. So maybe next time I need to do a street intercept survey. I'll consider that. But I do think that this really speaks to...
Interesting.
That would be challenging. We'd need Central. We're going to have to talk about that one. But I do think we all know the sample bias that's introduced by doing clinic-based samples. I think that this just added another layer that what wasn't captured in this data is that structural level stigma. But I think that the inferences that we can draw in terms of what we're seeing is very much being played out here. Also, in terms of the personal context, there's no way that I, as a white female researcher who's not living in Jackson, Mississippi, could have understood the clinic dynamics without working hand-in-hand with my local partners. And I think critically, at the end of this presentation, I actually can't say anything as to why I think the HIV epidemic is what it is in Jackson, Mississippi. We're not asking the right questions, and we're not engaging the right people to know what questions we should be asking. And I think it really highlights the importance of meaningful participation of your local collaborators to make sure that we can get it right. The last piece of what I want to say in my 1 minute is the political context. So there was Senate Bill 2681. It was titled the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I was actually in Jackson, Mississippi when this was passed. Essentially, what this Senate bill was about was saying that you do not have to provide services to someone if you feel that they act in a way that is not consistent with your religious beliefs. Okay? Within a week of this passing, I had 2 of my LGBT colleagues lose their jobs, and I had several others say that they went into places for public service and they would not be served because of their perceived sexual orientation. This was in July of 2014, right? And so this is happening now. This is not something that we're talking about the 1960s or 70s. And so I really don't want to end on a Debbie Downer note or in this incredibly emotional state, but I think it's so important that we remember what we're doing. And even though I feel my hands are tied, and again, that I'm not leaving you with any answers, but instead more questions, that we've got to make sure that we're doing it right, because this is something that's happening right here and right now and is more important than anything else. Thank you.
Thank you. Any burning questions for Dr. McCarthy?
Sure. I think that's always a question that you're always a doubt that you're going to have. I think, you know, in terms of potential other things that could be driving it, there's been some look at concurrency. There's been some look at networks. I also just wonder if you're talking about 10 people, and if 4 people are HIV positive, and you have an oopsie daisy moment, like the implications of that oopsie daisy moment in Jackson, Mississippi, as compared to New Orleans is not a good example. Some other city? So I think it's a great point, and I think it's one of the things that's always challenging, and you just try and really build the rapport and trust, et cetera, when you talk about that.
Okay.
But great point.
Yeah.